the great hall of Ravenmoor Manor glowed with the light of 100 candles, and the air smelled of beeswax and hothouse roses, and the faint, sweet sting of orange peel that someone had tossed into the fire. Music drifted from the far end of the room, where a string quartet played a tune that everyone seemed to know, but no one was really listening to. Silk rustled. Slippers whispered against the polished floor. Somewhere a woman laughed too loudly, and somewhere else a man cleared his throat in that careful way men do when they want to seem important. Vivian Marchcroft stood behind a tall potted palm near the east wall and tried very hard to disappear. She had chosen this spot for a reason. The palm was wide and the shadow it cast was deep, and from here she could see the whole ballroom without being seen herself. That was the point. She had not wanted to come. She had told her aunt as much, 3 times, in 3 different ways, and her aunt had only smiled that thin smile of hers and said that a girl of 22 could not afford to be choosy about invitations. So Vivian had put on the pale blue silk dress that had once belonged to her mother, and she had pinned her dark hair up with the silver combs that had also once belonged to her mother, and she had come. But she had not come to dance. She pressed her back a little closer to the cool plaster of the wall. The plaster was cold even through the silk, and the cold was a comfort. It reminded her she was real. Her gloved fingers found the small folded paper tucked inside her sleeve, and she touched its edge through the fabric. The paper had been there for 3 days now. She had not opened it again since the morning it came. She did not need to. She knew what it said. A footman passed by carrying a tray of small glasses, and the smell of sweet wine drifted after him. Vivian did not take one. She watched the dancers instead. They moved in their neat patterns, 2 by 2, hands raised, hands lowered, turning, turning. She had once known how to do that. She had been taught, the way every girl of her station was taught, when she was 12 years old. She had not danced since she was 17. A pair of older women drifted near her hiding place, and she went still. She held her breath. "Did you hear," said the first, "that he is coming tonight?" "Coming here," said the second. "To Ravenmoor. I thought he never left the north." "That is what I heard. But Lady Pellingham has been telling everyone for a week. She said he wrote her himself." "Then she is telling everyone because she wants her Honoria seen by him." "Of course she does. Wouldn't you?" They laughed together, the soft, cruel laugh of women who had been beautiful once and now ruled by other means. And they drifted away again toward the punch table. Vivian let out her breath slowly. She did not need to ask who he was. The whole county had been talking of nothing else for a fortnight. The Duke of Ashenholt had been a name spoken in hushed tones for as long as Vivian could remember. But in the last year that hush had turned into a roar. He had inherited the title from a cousin no one had expected him to inherit from. He had buried his young wife 3 years before that in a quiet ceremony at the family chapel, and he had not been seen in society since. He owned half the moors north of York, the gossip said. He owned ships. He owned a mine. He owned, it was rumoured, the road that ran past his estate. And he had once stopped a coach upon it and asked the driver his business and let him pass only when satisfied. Vivian had never seen him. She had no wish to. Men with that much weight in the world made her tired. She glanced toward the front of the hall, where the great double doors stood open. The footman there had begun to stand a little straighter in the last quarter hour. Something was coming. She could feel it in the room, the way one feels the air change before a storm. Conversations had grown a little brighter, a little louder, as if everyone were trying to be heard by someone who was not yet there. She slipped back deeper behind the palm. She did not want to be seen tonight, not by anyone. She had her reasons, and the chief reason was folded in her sleeve. The paper there had come from a solicitor in town. It said, in the polite, cold way such papers always said such things, that her late father's last debt had come due. That the small house in Larkinmere that her aunt had been so generous as to let her live in was no longer hers to live in, and that the gentleman who held the note had given her until the first of next month to make herself elsewhere. There had been a line at the bottom of the paper, in a different hand, that suggested the gentleman might be willing to reconsider his demand if certain matters were arranged in his favour. Vivian knew what those certain matters were. She had not told her aunt. She had not told anyone. She had come to this ball tonight because her aunt had ordered it, and because tomorrow she would need to walk into the village and ask the curate's wife whether the school there might want a new teacher. And a girl could not ask such a thing without first appearing in society at least once a season, to prove she had not yet given up. That was how it worked. You had to seem fine before you were allowed to be desperate. She touched the paper again. The musicians changed their tune. A new dance began, slower than the last, and the dancers laughed and repaired and started again. Across the room she could see her aunt, Lady Cordelia Marchcroft, in her plum-coloured gown, talking with great animation to a thin gentleman in a black coat. Her aunt did not look for her. Her aunt rarely did. That was when the room changed. It was a small change at first. The footmen at the great doors straightened their backs. The butler stepped forward. He did not announce anything. He only opened the inner door a little wider, and a man walked through. Vivian saw him before she meant to. He was not what she had expected. She had expected, she supposed, a man in glittering blue, with gold at his throat and rings on his fingers. She had expected the sort of duke one saw painted on the walls of grand houses, posed against a window, with a hand resting lightly on a sword. This man wore no sword. He wore a dark coat, very plain, and a white shirt under it, and his only ornament was a single dull silver pin at his collar. His hair was dark and cut close. His face was the kind of face that did not give itself away. He did not look at the room. He looked through it, the way a man looks through a window at the weather. He took two steps inside and stopped. The room stopped with him. It was not anything anyone did. Nobody fell silent. The music did not stutter. The dancers kept turning, but something underneath the noise of the room shifted, the way a tide shifts under the surface of the sea. Vivian felt it from her place behind the palm. She felt the air change. He moved. He moved through the room with a quiet that was somehow louder than any announcement. People made way for him without seeming to. Lady Pellingham, who Vivian could see from her place, drew her daughter Honoria forward at once. Honoria was very pretty tonight, in a gown the colour of cream, with pearls at her throat. She curtsied beautifully. The Duke inclined his head. He did not stop walking. Lady Pellingham's face did a small thing that Vivian almost felt sorry for. He passed two more girls who had been positioned, by their mothers, in the direct path he might be expected to take. He inclined his head to each. He did not stop. He did not slow. He walked across the room as if he were looking for something he had lost, and the dancers parted for him as if they too had been hired for the purpose. Vivian pressed herself further into the shadow of the palm and held very still. He could not be looking for her. There was no reason on earth he should be.
She had never met him. She had never been to one of his properties. She had never written to him, never spoken his name, never sent him so much as a Christmas card. She did not exist for him. She did not exist for most people. That was the point of standing behind palms. But his steps did not slow. He was walking toward the east wall now. He was walking toward the corner where she stood. Vivian's breath caught somewhere in the middle of her chest and refused to come up or go down. She could see his eyes now. They were grey, the deep grey of a winter sky just before the snow comes. They were not searching the room anymore. They had stopped searching. They had found. He stopped 3 feet from the palm. He did not say her name. He did not say anything at all. He simply stood there and looked at her where she had thought herself hidden, and waited. She did not curtsy. She could not. Her knees would not have allowed it. The silk of her glove had begun to feel hot against the folded paper in her sleeve, and the cold of the wall behind her had gone away as if it had never been there. She could hear the blood in her ears more clearly than she could hear the music. "You are Miss Marchcroft," he said. His voice was quieter than she had imagined, not soft. quiet. There was a difference. She did not trust her own voice yet, so she only inclined her head a very little. The candlelight caught one of the silver combs in her hair and threw it back at him, and she saw his eyes follow the light for half a second before they returned to her face. "I had hoped," he said, "to find you here." Around them, the room had begun to notice. She could feel the attention turning toward the corner where she stood, the way one feels the sun come out from behind a cloud. The two older women who had passed her earlier had paused at the punch table and were no longer pretending to drink. Lady Pellingham, near the dance floor, had turned her whole body in their direction. Even Vivian's aunt, across the hall, had stopped talking to her thin gentleman in the black coat. Vivian found her voice at last, and was surprised at how steady it came out. "I do not believe we have been introduced, Your Grace." "No," he said, "we have not." He said it simply, as if it were a fact about the weather. Then he waited. The waiting was the thing. The waiting was what made her understand he was not going anywhere. He had not crossed the room to make a show. He had not crossed it to humiliate Lady Pellingham, or to slight Honoria, or to give the gossip writers something to do tomorrow. He had crossed it because he had come here to find her. And now he had found her, and he was waiting to see what she would do about it. She thought about all the answers a girl was supposed to give. She thought about the curtsy and the lowered eyes, and the soft, pretty thing one was meant to say. She thought about how she had not the strength for any of it. So she said, "Why?" She heard a small, sharp sound from somewhere on her left. It might have been Lady Pellingham. It might have been one of the older women at the punch table. It did not matter. The Duke of Ashenholt looked at her with those winter eyes, and for one moment something flickered in them that might have been surprise, and might have been something else. "That is a long answer," he said. "Will you walk with me?" She did not move. She could not have said why she did not move. She had no good reason to refuse. Refusal would be a scandal. Refusal would be discussed at every breakfast table within 10 miles tomorrow morning. And her aunt would not forgive her, and the curate's wife would not give her the school after all. Refusal was a small disaster she could not afford, but she did not move. "Your Grace," she said very quietly, "I think you have made a mistake." "No," he said, "I have not." The music kept playing, the dancers kept turning, but the corner where they stood had gone still around them, and Vivienne understood, in a way she had not understood anything for a long time, that whatever this was, it was not going to be over quickly. "Please," he said, and there was something in the word that was not what she expected. It was not the please of a man asking for a favor. It was something nearer to the please of a man asking for a chance. "Just to the conservatory door. There is air there. You look as if you need air." She did need air. She had not known she did until he said it. She nodded once, very small, and he stepped back to let her come out from behind the palm, and he did not offer his arm. She noticed that. He did not offer his arm because to offer his arm would have been to claim her in front of the room, and to claim her in front of the room would have been to take from her the only thing she had left, which was the right to walk out of this corner under her own power. He saw that. Somehow, he saw that. He let her come out as if she were any guest who happened to be walking the same direction as he was, and they crossed the side of the ballroom together with a space of 3 feet between them, and they reached the great glass doors of the conservatory, and he opened one of them himself and stood aside, and she went through. The conservatory smelled of orange leaves and damp earth, and a strange sweet flower she did not know the name of. The air was warm and wet, the way the air had been in her grandmother's old greenhouse when she was a child, and the warmth made her eyes sting for a reason she did not understand. There were lanterns hung from the iron beams. The light was lower here, gentler, and the sounds of the ball came through the glass like sounds underwater. He shut the door behind them. He did not move closer. They stood several feet apart, among the orange trees, and she heard somewhere overhead the small soft drip of water from a fern that had been newly watered. A drop fell on the back of her glove and soaked through the silk, and she felt the small cold spot of it on her wrist. "You asked me why," he said. "I did." He looked down at his own hands for a moment, and she noticed they were not still. They were quiet, but they were not still. There was a knuckle on his right hand that he kept pressing with the thumb of his left, slowly, as if it ached. 3 years ago," he said, "my sister was very ill." Vivian said nothing. She did not know what he was asking of her, but she knew the way one knows certain things that the only right thing to do now was to let him speak. "She lived in Larkinmere," he said. "She had married a man who did not deserve her. He had taken her there, and he had spent her money. And when she fell ill, he would not pay for a doctor. She was alone in that house for a long time. I was in the north. I did not know." He pressed the knuckle again. "There was a young woman," he said, "who lived next door. She had no reason to involve herself. She had no money herself, and her father had just died, and she had her own troubles. But she walked over every morning, and she sat with my sister, and she read to her, and she brought soup that she had made herself with what little she had. She did this for 2 months. She wrote me one letter, only one, in which she did not ask for anything. She only told me that my sister was speaking of me, and that perhaps if I could come, it would be a kindness." Vivienne had gone very still. "I came," he said. "I came as quickly as I could. It was not quickly enough. My sister died 3 days after I arrived. But she was not alone when I got there. She was being held by a young woman with dark hair, who did not know I had come into the room until I spoke. And when she heard me speak, she stood, and she gave me back my sister, and she went out of the room so that the last hours would belong to me. She did not tell me her name."
I asked the housekeeper afterward, but the housekeeper had only ever called her the girl from next door. By the time I thought to send and inquire, she had left Larkinmere. Her father's house had been sold for debt. No one knew where she had gone. He looked up at her. "It has taken me 3 years," he said, "to find her." Vivian's hand went, without her telling it to her sleeve, where the folded paper lay. She felt the edge of it against her wrist. "Your Grace," she said, and her voice was not steady anymore. "Why did you not say so? 3 years ago, why did you not say anything at all?" "I did not know what to say." He looked at her, and his face had no defenses left in it now. "I did not know you. I knew only what you had done. And to come to a young woman who had lost her father and her home, and ask her, on the basis of 2 months of kindness to a dying stranger, to know me, I thought it was not fair. So I waited. I made inquiries. I learned what I could of you. I learned 6 months ago where you were living, and I learned 3 days ago who held the note on your father's last debt." She looked at him very sharply then. "You bought it," she said. "No," he said. "I did not buy it. I would not buy a thing that gave a man power over you. I went to him and I told him that he would forgive it, or I would make certain that no honest man in this county would ever do business with him again. He chose to forgive it. The papers are with my solicitor. They will come to you in the morning, with no obligation to me of any kind. Whatever you choose to do tonight, the house in Larkinmere is yours, free and unencumbered, as it should have been from the start." Vivian pressed the back of her hand against her mouth. She had been ready tonight to be made small. She had been ready to walk back into Larkinmere tomorrow and ask the curate's wife about a teaching post and pretend she was fine. She had been ready, at the bottom of herself, in a place she had not let herself look, to consider the gentleman's offer, the one written at the bottom of the paper, because she had not seen any other road open. She had been ready for 100 things. She had not been ready for this. She turned away from him for a moment. She did not want him to see her face. She heard him not move. He stood where he had stood, 3 feet from her, and he let her have her back to him for as long as she needed. When she turned around again, she said, "I do not want your gratitude, Your Grace." "I am not offering you gratitude," he said. "I paid that debt for my sister, not for you."
That, somehow, was the right thing to say.
If he had said anything else, if he had said he had done it for her, if he had said he had done it because he was a good man, if he had said he had done it because he wanted her to think well of him, she would have walked out of the conservatory and out of the manor and into the cold of the night and never looked back. But he had not said any of those things. He had said he had done it for his sister, and that was a debt that had nothing to do with her at all, and she could accept it the way one accepts that the sun has risen. "Then why," she said, "did you come tonight?" "Because the debt to my sister has been paid," he said. "And there is another matter, which is mine alone." He took half a step closer and stopped. "I have wanted for 3 years," he said, "to thank the young woman who sat with my sister. I had no right to anything more than that. I still have no right to anything more than that. But I would like, if you will allow it, to know your name. Properly. Not from a housekeeper. From you." She looked at him a long moment. The water dripped again somewhere above them into a stone basin she could not see. "Vivian," she said very quietly. "Vivian Marchcroft." "Miss Marchcroft," he said, and he bowed his head, and for the first time since he had walked into the ballroom, there was something in his face that was not the heavy quiet of the man who had crossed the room. It was something younger, something almost shy. She did not know what to do with it, so she said the thing she could say. "Your sister," she said, "talked about you every day. She said you used to climb the oak tree at your grandfather's house and read books up in the branches, and your tutor could never find you. She said you were not as cold as you pretended to be. She said it twice. She wanted me to know." Something moved in his throat. He did not answer her at once. When he did, his voice had gone rougher than it had been before. "Thank you," he said. "I had not known she spoke of me." "She spoke of you a great deal," Vivian said. There was a silence between them then that was not awkward. It was the kind of silence that comes when two people have said something true and are letting it sit in the air for a little while before doing anything else with it. Through the glass of the conservatory door she could see the ballroom. The dancers had finished their figure. People were standing about with glasses in their hands, talking, and many of them were looking at the conservatory door. Lady Pellingham was looking at the conservatory door. Her aunt was looking at the conservatory door. Honoria was looking at the floor. Vivian drew a long breath. "They are going to talk," she said. "Yes," he said, "they are. They will say I planned this." "They may." "They will say I came here tonight to be seen by you." "Yes." "That is not true," she said. "I came here tonight because my aunt made me come. I came here hoping not to be seen by anyone at all. I came here behind a palm tree, Your Grace. I do not want anyone to think I came here to catch you." "I know you did not." "Do you?" "Miss Marchcroft," he said, "I have spent 3 years learning what kind of woman would sit with a dying stranger for 2 months and ask nothing of anyone afterward. You did not come here tonight to catch me. You came here to survive an evening. I came here to ruin that plan. The fault is mine, and the talk will be mine. I will say so plainly before I leave tonight, to anyone who asks." She almost smiled at that. It was a small thing, half a movement of her mouth, but it was there. "You cannot say that to the whole room." "I can say it to Lady Pellingham. The rest of the county will know by morning." She did smile then. It was a small, wry thing. He saw it. He did not smile back, but his eyes changed. "Will you allow me," he said, "to call on you? In Larkinmere. In a fortnight. I will not come sooner. I will not come at all if you would rather I did not. You are under no obligation. I will not be offended." Vivian looked at him. She thought of the folded paper in her sleeve, which she would burn tonight in the candle on her bedside table. She thought of the house in Larkinmere, which had a small garden in the back where her father had planted apple trees when she was a child, and which she had thought she would never sleep in again after next month. She thought of his sister, whose name had been Marguerite,
and who had laughed weakly at her own jokes, even when she could no longer lift her head. She thought of his eyes when she had told him about the oak tree and how something in his throat had moved. "In a fortnight," she said. "Yes, you may call." He bowed. "Then I will not keep you any longer tonight," he said. "I think you would like to go home." "I would," she said. "Will you allow me to send my carriage?" "My aunt has a carriage." "Your aunt has a carriage," he said, "and she has been watching this door for the last quarter of an hour, and she will have a great many questions for you on the ride home that you do not owe her answers to. I would like, if you will let me, to send you back to Larkinmere in my carriage. You would not have to speak to anyone, not even me. The footmen are mine. They will not gossip."
"I will tell your aunt myself that you have gone, and I will tell her in such a way that she will not blame you for it."
Vivian looked at him. "That is a great deal of kindness," she said, "for a woman you do not know." "I have just told you," he said, "that I have spent 3 years learning who you are. You are not a woman I do not know. You are only a woman who does not yet know me." She held his eyes for a long moment. Then she nodded. "Thank you," she said. "I would like the carriage." He inclined his head. He turned, and he opened the conservatory door for her, and they stepped back into the ballroom together. The room had not stopped looking at the door. It started to look harder. He did not offer his arm. He walked her along the side of the hall, 3 feet of clear space between them, and at the great front doors he stopped and turned to her and bowed properly, the way one bows to a lady at the close of a ball. "Miss Marchcroft," he said. "Your Grace," she said. She passed out through the doors. A footman went before her. The carriage was already waiting on the gravel. The night air was cold and smelled of horses and the wet leaves of the autumn trees, and she breathed it in and felt, for the first time in 3 days, that her chest could open all the way. She heard behind her, as the doors began to close, his voice in the hall. It was not loud. It did not need to be. The hall had gone quiet for it. "Lady Pellingham," he said, "if anyone tonight asks you about Miss Marchcroft, I would be obliged if you would tell them that she came here this evening at my particular request, and that the fault for any awkwardness lies entirely with me." There was a small silence. "Of course, Your Grace," said Lady Pellingham, in a voice that was not quite her usual one. The doors closed. The footman handed Vivian into the carriage. The door shut. The horses moved. The lights of Ravenmoor fell behind. She sat alone on the dark leather seat, with the smell of new wax and old wood around her, and she pulled the folded paper from her sleeve, and she looked at it in the small light of the carriage lamp. Then she folded it again, and she put it back in her sleeve, and she leaned her head against the window glass, and she watched the dark lanes of the county roll past. The carriage took her to Larkinmere by lanes she knew. Her own small house, when they reached it, stood quiet at the end of its lane, the windows dark, the lamp in the hall left burning by Mrs. Holbrook, the housekeeper, who would have gone to bed by now. The footman handed Vivian down. He bowed. He did not speak. He climbed back to his place, and the carriage turned, and the sound of its wheels faded into the dark. Vivian stood in her own front garden for a long moment before she went inside. The apple trees her father had planted were bare now, their leaves on the ground. A small wind moved among the branches. From the back of the house she could hear the slow, distant lowing of the Tuke's cow, 2 fields over, who lowed every night about this time because the Tuke's youngest daughter was always late bringing her in. The sound was so ordinary, it almost made her laugh. She went inside. She did not light a candle in the parlour. She walked through it by the light from the hall, and she went up the narrow stairs to her own bedroom, and she sat down on the edge of her bed in her pale blue silk dress without taking it off. She took the folded paper from her sleeve. She held it for a long time. Then she went to her candle, and she lit it from the little oil lamp on the table, and she held the paper to the flame until the corner caught. She watched it burn down. The smell of the burning paper was sharp and bitter.
She held it over the small basin on her washstand until there was nothing left of it but a curl of grey ash, and she dropped the last bit in, and she put her hands over her face, and she did not cry. She did not cry. She only sat there for a long time with her hands over her face and breathed. And when she took her hands away, she was a different person from the one who had walked into Ravenmoor that evening. In the morning the papers came, as he had said. A young man rode up from town and gave them to Mrs. Holbrook at the kitchen door, and Mrs. Holbrook brought them up to Vivian in the breakfast room and laid them beside her cup with her eyebrows raised and her mouth firmly shut. Because Mrs. Holbrook had been with the family for 16 years and knew when to ask questions and when not to. Vivian read the papers. The house in Larkinmere was hers, free of any claim. The gentleman who had held the note had withdrawn it. There was a brief covering letter from a solicitor in town, polite and dry. There was no letter from the Duke of Ashenholt. That was the right thing, she thought. He had said he would not come for a fortnight, and so he was not going to send her even so much as a line in the interval. He was a man who kept the small words he gave as carefully as he kept the great ones. The fortnight passed slowly. It passed slowly in part because the gossip from the ball had arrived in Larkinmere by Wednesday, and by Thursday the curate's wife had called, and on Friday three other women called, and on Saturday Vivian's aunt arrived in her own carriage, in a state of high feeling. Vivian received them all in the small front parlour, with the applewood fire going, and she answered their questions as little as she could, and her aunt left more confused than she had come. The county settled, very gradually, on a story that suited it, that Miss Marchcroft had been a friend of the late Duchess of Ashenholtz, and that the Duke had come to Ravenmoor expressly to thank her for kindnesses shown to his late sister, and that there was nothing more in it than that, although of course there might be. The county liked an open ending. They could close it themselves at leisure. In the second week of the fortnight, Vivian walked into the village on a cold, bright morning to fetch a packet of pins from Mrs. Helverton's shop. She was crossing the square when she saw something that stopped her. Old Mr. Greaves, the chandler, who was 83 and had been the chandler in Larkinmere since before Vivian was born, was sitting on the bench outside his shop with a blanket over his knees. This was unusual. Mr. Greaves did not sit on the bench in November. Mr. Greaves did not own a blanket of the kind that was over his knees, which was a heavy plaid wool of the sort one saw on northern hills. Vivian crossed the square and asked Mrs. Helverton, who was sweeping her own doorstep, what had happened. "Oh, Miss Marchcroft," said Mrs. Helverton, who liked a story. "He fell, didn't he? Tuesday last. Slipped on the cobbles outside the church and could not get up. He was there a good half hour before anyone found him. He cannot put weight on his left ankle yet. The doctor says he must sit out of doors when the sun is good, because the chandler's shop has no good light for healing. He sits there every morning now." "And the blanket?" said Vivian. "Ah," said Mrs. Helverton. "Now that is the queer thing. The blanket was sent. Tuesday afternoon, a young man came on horseback, not from this county, and he gave it to Mr. Greaves's niece, and he said it was sent by a gentleman who had heard of the chandler's fall and wished him well. No name, no card. The young man rode off and never said another word. Mr. Greaves's niece thinks it was the squire over at Hartshill, but the squire denies it. So nobody knows." Vivian stood very still on Mrs. Helverton's step. "How would the squire have heard about Mr. Greaves's fall by Tuesday afternoon?" she said. "That is exactly the question," said Mrs. Helverton, who liked her own cleverness. "He could not have heard. Nobody outside the village had heard. The only person from outside the village who has been through here this week was that young rider with the blanket." Vivian thanked Mrs. Helverton and went into the shop and bought her pins and walked home with them. She walked home thinking, because she could not help thinking, about a thing she had said to the Duke of Ashenholt on the night of the ball that she had quite forgotten she had said. He had asked her, as they stood in the conservatory, about Larkinmere. He had asked her what she would do if the house were saved. She had told him she would go on living in it. She had told him that she liked the village, that the village had been kind to her father in his last illness, She had said one specific thing. She had not even meant to say it. It had only come out. About the old chandler, Mr. Greaves, who had given her a candle for nothing once, when she was a little girl, and had broken her mother's good one, and was crying in his shop. She had told the Duke that, and she had not thought of it again until now. He had remembered. He had remembered. And he had sent a blanket, and he had not put his name on it, and he had not told her about it. And she had only learned of it because Mrs. Helverton was a great gossip. She walked home very slowly. She did not mention it when he came to call. He came on the 14th day exactly. He came alone, in a plain coat, in a plain carriage with no crest on it, and he was shown into the front parlour by Mrs. Holbrook, who watched him as if he were a wolf that had wandered into the chickens, and he sat down on the small chair across from Vivian's larger one, and he placed his hat on his knee. "Miss Marchcroft," he said. "Your Grace," she said. There was a small silence. "You look well," he said. "I had wondered." "I have been well," she said. "The papers came as you said." "I am glad." "Thank you," she said, "for what you did." "You have already thanked me. You did not need to." "I needed to," she said. "I would not have you think I do not know." He inclined his head. Mrs. Holbrook brought tea. The cups rattled a little as she set them down, because Mrs. Holbrook was nervous, although she would never admit it. The tea steamed. The fire crackled. Outside, a single bird called from the apple trees in the garden. He stayed half an hour. He spoke quietly, of small things. The road, the weather, which had turned colder, a book he was reading which he had not yet finished, and which he did not push her to read. She spoke back, of small things in return. The village, her own small concerns.
She did not mention the chandler. He did not mention the chandler.
They drank tea, and he set his cup down precisely each time, and the half hour passed. At the end of the half hour, he stood up. "Miss Marchcroft," he said, "may I call again next week?" "Yes," she said. He bowed. He left. Mrs. Holbrook came in afterward and stood in the doorway with her hands on her hips and said, "Miss Vivian, if you are not going to tell me what is happening in this house, I shall ask Mrs. Helverton, and you know I do not like asking Mrs. Helverton anything." Vivian laughed, properly, for the first time in 3 years. He came again the next week, and the week after that. He came on Wednesday afternoons at 3 o'clock and stayed half an hour. He never came earlier. He never stayed longer. He came in his plain coat, in his plain carriage, and he sat in the small chair across from her larger one, and they spoke of small things, and Mrs. Holbrook brought tea, and at the end of half an hour, he stood up and bowed and left. This went on through November and into December. The county talked, of course. The county had not stopped talking since the night of the ball. But the Duke called on Wednesdays only, and he was seen each time arriving and leaving in his plain carriage in broad daylight, with Mrs. Holbrook in the house the whole time, and the county could not, for all its trying, make a scandal of half an hour of tea on a Wednesday afternoon. Lady Pellingham, who had been quite cold to Vivian on first hearing the news, was now seen to nod stiffly to her in church. Vivian's aunt called twice, and each time went away again, with the look of a woman who could not quite work out what game was being played. In the first week of December, a hard frost came down over the county. The apple trees in Vivian's garden stood white and silver, every twig outlined in ice, and the lanes glittered, and the cow in the Tuke's field lowed in the cold each evening as Vivian sat by the fire with her sewing on her lap. She had begun, since the night of the ball, to do small things she had not done in years. She had taken up her old needlework. She had walked in the village more. She had begun, very tentatively, to teach reading 2 mornings a week to 3 girls of the village whose mothers wanted them to learn, and who came to her small parlour at 9 in the morning and went home again at 11. On the second Wednesday of December, the Duke of Ashenholt arrived at 3 o'clock as usual. But he did not sit down. He stood by the window of the parlour with his hat in his hands,
and he looked at the frost on the apple trees outside, and he did not turn to her at once.
"Miss Marchcroft," he said, "there is a matter I have not raised with you."
Vivian set down her teacup.
"Yes," she said.
"Lady Pellingham," he said, "has invited me to a private dinner at her house on Friday. It is, I believe, intended to remind the county that her daughter Honoria is still unmarried."
"I see," said Vivian. "I will not be attending."
"Oh," said Vivian. He turned then, and he looked at her, and his grey eyes had something in them that was not quite the quiet of the man who had come into the ballroom 7 weeks ago. There was something younger in his face again, the way there had been in the conservatory.
"I should like, on Friday," he said, "to take you to my own house. Not to my house in the north, that is too far, but to my smaller house near Greenmere, an hour from here. There is no party, there is no event. There is only my old aunt who lives there, who knew my sister, and who has asked 3 times in 3 letters whether she might meet you. I have not given her your name. I would not until I had asked you. But I should like, if you would allow it, to take you to meet her. We would go in the morning and return before dark. We would not be alone in the carriage. Mrs. Holbrook may come, if you would prefer. My aunt is quite old and quite plain-spoken. She frightens most people. I do not think she will frighten you."
Vivian sat for a moment with her hands very still in her lap.
"Why?" she said.
It was the same word she had said to him on the night of the ball. He answered it the same way he had answered it then, with honesty.
"Because in 6 weeks of Wednesdays," he said, "I have not yet asked you a single question I really wanted to ask. I have not asked them because I was afraid you would think I was claiming something I have no right to claim. I have been very careful, Miss Marchcroft. I have perhaps been too careful. My aunt will not be careful. My aunt will ask you everything I have not asked, and she will do it kindly. And at the end of the day, you will know me a great deal better than you do now. And then, if you wish, on the next Wednesday after that, you may tell me whether I should keep calling."
Vivian looked at him. She thought of the blanket on the chandler. She thought of his face in the conservatory when she had told him about the oak tree. She thought of how he had walked across the ballroom 7 weeks ago, past Lady Pellingham and Honoria and all the other careful daughters of careful mothers, and how he had not slowed for any of them, and how he had not, in 7 weeks of Wednesdays, asked her for anything at all.
"Mrs. Holbrook will come," she said.
"Yes, I should like to meet your aunt."
He nodded once. He sat down at last. He drank his tea. The frost lay on the apple trees outside. They went on Friday. The carriage that came was the same plain one he had used every Wednesday. Mrs. Holbrook sat with Vivian on one side, and the Duke sat on the other, and the 3 of them rode the hour to Greenmere in a steady, careful quiet. The country was white and bright with frost. The horse's breath went up in clouds. Vivian sat with her gloved hands folded in her lap and watched the country go past. And once, when the carriage rounded a bend, she caught the Duke's eye by accident, and he did not look away. The house at Greenmere was smaller than she had expected. It was a stone house, 2 stories high, set against a wood with a stream running by it. Smoke rose from 2 chimneys. An old gardener was breaking the ice in a water trough as the carriage pulled up. The Duke's aunt was waiting in the front hall. She was a small woman of perhaps 80 years, in a grey wool dress, with a thin gold chain at her throat and white hair pinned simply. She did not curtsy. She did not move toward them with her arms out. She stood where she was, and she looked at Vivian for a long moment with eyes that were very like the Duke's, and then she said, "So, you are the girl from next door?"
"I am," said Vivian. "You read to my niece for 2 months."
"Yes. And you have not asked anything of my nephew, even after he ran across a ballroom in front of half of England to find you?"
"No," said Vivian, "I have not."
"Good," said the old woman. "Take off your coat. The fire is in the small drawing room. Mrs. Holbrook, the housekeeper, has tea for you in the kitchen if you would like it."
Mrs. Holbrook, who was not easily impressed, looked rather impressed, and she allowed herself to be led away. Vivian sat with the old woman in the small drawing room for 2 hours. The Duke sat with them, but he said almost nothing. He let his aunt talk. His aunt asked Vivian a great many questions in a plain and steady way, and Vivian answered them. She asked about Vivian's father. She asked about Vivian's mother, who had died when Vivian was 9. She asked about the apple trees. She asked about the Chandler, although Vivian had not told her of the Chandler, and Vivian realized, looking at the old woman's face, that her nephew had told her. She asked about the school for the 3 village girls. She asked about Marguerite. She did not ask about Marguerite cruelly. She asked about her the way one asks about a person one has loved and lost, and Vivian answered her with everything she could remember.
At the end of the 2 hours, the old woman took Vivian's hand in her own thin one and held it for a moment.
"My dear," she said, "I am very glad you came."
"Thank you," said Vivian. Her voice was not quite steady.
"My nephew," said the old woman, "is not an easy man. He is not cold. He is the opposite of cold. He feels too much, and he has trained himself since he was a boy not to show it. You will have to learn to read him by very small things. The way he sets down a cup, the way he stands at a window, the way he does not say a thing when most men would say it."
"I am learning," said Vivian.
"I can see that," said the old woman. She let go of Vivian's hand. The ride home was quieter than the ride out had been. Mrs. Hulbrook fell asleep against the window of the carriage almost at once. The Duke and Vivian sat across from each other and did not speak for a long time. When they had been riding for perhaps half an hour, Vivian said, "You told her about the Chandler." He did not pretend not to know what she meant.
"Yes," he said.
"You did not put your name on the blanket."
"No."
"Why not?" He looked out the window for a moment. The light was beginning to go. The shadows of the trees were stretching long across the lane.
"Because it was not for you," he said. "It was for him. If I had put my name on it, it would have become a thing about me. I did not want it to be a thing about me. The man broke his ankle and the man was cold. The blanket was about that."
Vivian nodded. She looked down at her own gloved hands in her lap.
"Mrs. Helverton told me," she said.
"Mrs. Helverton is a great gossip," he said.
"She is," said Vivian. "I had not counted on her."
"You should have," said Vivian, and she almost smiled. He almost smiled back. The carriage rolled on. When they reached her own house in Larkinmere, the sky had gone the deep blue of a winter dusk, and the first star was out over the apple trees. The Duke handed Mrs. Holbrook down first, then he handed Vivian down. He held her gloved hand for one moment longer than was strictly necessary, and then he let it go.
"Miss Marchcroft," he said, "may I come on Wednesday?"
"Yes," she said.
"And the Wednesday after that?"
"Yes."
"And every Wednesday until I have made you tired of me?"
"Your Grace," she said, "I do not think that is a thing that is going to happen."
He looked at her. The dusk was deep enough now that she could not quite read his eyes.
"Miss Marchcroft," he said.
"Vivian."
He had not said her first name before. He said it now as if he had been keeping it carefully in his mouth for 7 weeks, waiting for the right moment to set it down. It came out very quiet.
The cold air took it and held it for a second between them.
"Your Grace," she said.
"Cassian," he said.
"If you will. When we are alone. When you are willing."
Vivian stood in her own front garden in the deep blue light. The first star was over the apple trees. The cow in the Tuke's field lowed once in the distance. Mrs. Holbrook had gone discreetly inside.
"Cassian," she said.
He bowed his head over her hand. He did not kiss it. He only held it, in his own gloved hand, for one slow moment, and then he let go, and he climbed back into the carriage, and the carriage moved off down the lane. Vivian stood in the garden and watched it go until it was only a sound, and then not even a sound, and then she went inside. Spring came late that year. It came hard and bright at the end of March, after a march of grey rain. The apple trees in Vivian's garden put out their pale buds and then their pale flowers, and the air around the house was thick with the smell of them. On a morning in early April, Cassian Ashenholt came to the small front parlour at his usual hour, although it was a Tuesday and not a Wednesday, and he stood in the doorway and would not sit down. "Miss Marchcroft," he said. "Vivian?" "Yes," she said. "I have come a day early." "I see that. I have come because I cannot wait until tomorrow." She set down her sewing. He crossed the room. He did not kneel. He was not a man who knelt. He stood in front of her chair, and he took her hand in both of his, and he looked down at her face. The morning light from the parlour window fell across half of him. The smell of the apple blossom came in through the open casement. Somewhere in the village, a dog was barking. Somewhere in the kitchen, Mrs. Holbrook was being very quiet on purpose. "I have nothing to offer you," he said, "that you do not already have. You have your house. You have your village. You have your school. You have my aunt, who loves you, and you have a fortnight of Wednesdays a year if you would prefer them to anything more. I will not press you. I will not ask you to be a duchess if the word frightens you. I will not take you north if you would rather stay south. I will not change you, Vivian. I have spent 3 years and 7 months learning who you are, and I do not wish to change one thing about you." He took a breath. "But I would like, if you will let me, to spend the rest of my life across a small table from you, on a Wednesday afternoon, in any house that you choose." Vivian looked up at him. She did not answer at once. She let the moment stretch out. She let herself feel it. The light on his face, the pressure of his hands around hers, the smell of the apple blossom, the bark of the dog. Mrs. Holbrook's silence in the kitchen, the faint warm scratch of the wool of her own sleeve where he had not quite let it go, the little catch of her own breath, the pulse, slow and steady, in her own throat. She thought of the girl she had been 7 months ago, behind a potted palm, with a folded paper in her sleeve, and no place left to go. She thought of the woman she was now, in a parlour full of apple flower light, with a duke standing in front of her chair and asking her a question she had never thought, in all of her life, that anyone was going to ask her. She thought of his sister, who had laughed weakly at her own jokes. She thought of an old chandler who had a blanket from no one. She thought of an oak tree in a grandfather's garden with a boy in its branches. "Cassian," she said. "Yes." He closed his eyes. He stood there with his eyes closed for a long moment, holding her hand in both of his, and she watched his face. She watched the small movement at the corner of his mouth. She watched the line of his jaw settle. She watched him let out a breath he had perhaps been holding since the night of the ball. Then he opened his eyes, and he looked at her. And he was simply a man, and she was simply a woman. And the morning came in through the window and lay on them both. They were married in the small chapel at Greenmere in June, with his aunt in the front pew on his side, and Mrs. Holbrook in the front pew on hers, and the three village girls from the school behind Mrs. Holbrook, in clean, white pinafores. Vivian wore the pale blue silk dress that had been her mother's. She wore the silver combs in her hair. She did not carry roses. She carried a small sprig of apple blossom that Mrs. Holbrook had cut that morning from the tree by the kitchen door of the house in Larkinmere. Lady Pellingham was not invited. Honoria Pellingham was not invited either. The old chandler, Mr. Greaves, was invited, but he was too lame to come. So they sent him a piece of the wedding cake afterward, by a boy on a pony, and the boy reported that Mr. Greaves had wept on his blanket. The county talked, of course. The county talked for a long time. The county said many things, most of them wrong. But by the autumn of that year, the county had begun to say one true thing, which was that the new Duchess of Ashenholt had a way of standing very still in a crowded room, the way an oak tree stands in a wood, and that the Duke of Ashenholt, who had been a cold man for many years, was not a cold man any longer. A year after the wedding, On a Wednesday afternoon in October, Vivian was sitting in the small drawing room of the house at Greenmere, where they had chosen to live, because neither of them had wanted the great house in the north, and they could not bear to give up the small house in Larkinmere. The window was open to the garden. The smell of the late apples was in the room. Somewhere in the back of the house, Mrs. Halbrook was scolding a kitchen girl in a soft, fond way she had developed in her old age. The fire was low. Vivian had her sewing on her lap. Cassian came in. He did not say anything. He sat down across from her, in the small chair he had sat in 7 Wednesdays in a row and 40 more Wednesdays after that. He set his book on the table at his elbow. He looked at her. She looked back at him. A cup of tea sat on the table between them. He did not pick it up. He only sat there, in the small chair, in the small drawing room, in the small house by the wood, on a Wednesday afternoon, looking at his wife. And his wife looked back, and she set down her sewing, and she did not say anything at all, and the apple-smelling air came in through the window, and the fire crackled, and Mrs. Halbrook scolded the kitchen girl in a voice that was full of love, and somewhere far away a cow lowed in a field, and Vivian Ashenholt thought, without putting it into words, that this was what people meant when they used the word home. Thank you for staying with this story until the very end. If this moved you, please like, share, and subscribe. Your support keeps these stories alive.